You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today we start off in Malibu. But no, we're not listening to the waves or dipping our toes in the sand. We're at a location much less romantic. It's a construction site for a rebuild.
This is going to be the living room area here.
This is going to be what?
The living room area.
Okay.
Yeah, and then my studio's in there. And upstairs is the whole kitchen and family room.
Guitarist Lee Ritenour lives here, or anyway he used to, for four decades. His home burned down in the 2018 Woolsey fire.
My wife grabbed a couple of things. I said, we'll be back tomorrow. Wrong. It was overwhelming that it was such a powerful fire.
It's a seasonal tradition in California. Homes burn down, and then we hear stories of human resilience, of fire victims promising to rebuild and recover. But once the smoke clears, they learn that's a difficult process that takes several years if you choose to stay at all. Today on Greater LA, KCRW's Kaylee Wells brings us the stories of people burnt out and trying to get back home.
Weaving through residential neighborhoods in the Woolsey fire burn scar, no two streets are the same. Some homes are untouched, some are partially built, some lots are completely empty, or they have an RV parked on a flat patch of dirt where they're just waiting for construction to start.
Even that afternoon of the fire, I kept saying, oh, no, it's not going to come across the highway. They'll stop it. You know, it never gets this far.
Ritenour is standing in what's going to be the second floor of his new home. For now, it's just wooden framing.
I mean, when a fire takes a neighborhood and takes your house, nobody knows what to expect. You know, it's like I had never had a house burn down.
The Woolsey fire was the most destructive fire in the greater L.A. area. More than 1,600 structures were lost, and compared to other people rebuilding, construction here is moving pretty quickly.
So we're about in the middle right now. You know, some houses are finished, some people are living in it, some people haven't even started, and we're about a year off from walking in the door.
2 days after the fire, Ritenour called the architect he wanted, and unlike a lot of his neighbors, he had up-to-date insurance coverage, so paying for the entire project wasn't a problem. But those are just the first steps.
So we hired public adjusters, and you go through this whole education of what needs to be done. Took 2 years to get that sorted out, you know. And then the plans and how you rebuild in the 300 pages of plans and architectural plan, and then permits and going through Malibu and Malibu.
And then he started building.
Very cool.
He and his wife were also two of the thousands of people vying for the attention of the same pool of contractors and permitting staff all at the same time, which slows down the expedited process that Malibu promised. Ritenour expects to turn the key on his new home in July of next year. But some people aren't so lucky. Kat Merrick thought she'd be back home by now. She lost her home in the 2017 Thomas fire, a year before Ritenour, and says it's still hard to talk about almost 4 years later.
You know, it was just devastating. You're in shock, and not only knowing that your house is gone, but that I would say over 100 friends that I know lost everything as well that night.
She sent in her building plans 3 years ago and is still waiting on Ventura County to approve them. And while she waits, she's living out of a mobile home on her property. But even that took 2.5 years to get approved. Before that, she was in an RV. Merrick says she'll end up paying for a lot of her house out of pocket because she, like so many others, was underinsured. That can happen if you buy a property and you don't update the insurance policy as the property value goes up. So if you bought a home for $500,000 and decades later it burns down and is worth $1 million, you're still insured for a $500,000 home.
It's been a nightmare. And I hear stories from so many others that are in the same boat we are. And they're just, some have given up.
And if you're renting, giving up can sometimes feel like the only option. That is the difficult choice that Desiree McAleer faced after the Valley Fire in 2015 up in Northern California.
I realized that staying in the area, as much as my heart wanted to stay with the community that I was in, that for my own healing, I needed to move. And I tell people, it's like an abusive situation. So if you're in an abusive relationship, you leave that abusive relationship and you try to get into a new one.
The Valley Fire moved so fast, McAleer never got an evacuation notice. Her neighbor didn't get out in time and died. Her employer owned the home, and the property insurance gave her a few thousand for everything she lost inside the home. She jumped from couch to couch for a year before she picked up her life and moved to Southern California. Dave McLaughlin has seen fire victims leave his neighborhood, too. He lives in Malibu Lake, and he's also a real estate agent there. It's tough to find a home there that goes for less than $1 million. The Woolsey fire burned down his garage, and the insurance didn't come close to covering it. But sitting on his porch, the part of his home that did survive, he says of the roughly 200 homes around Malibu Lake, 55 burned in the fire.
I don't think one has been fully rebuilt yet. I think there's, I'm looking around the lake right now, counting 1, 2, 3, 4 down the lakeside, 5, probably 7 underway, 7 of those 55.
On some of the burned out lots, the evidence of tragedy is sobering. There's rubble of one home, but the chimney is still fully intact. On another, only the stone foundation remains. There's a concrete slab where two small hands and a pair of initials made their mark 8 years ago. He says it was tough selling a home right after the fire because the insurance was so expensive and there wasn't much interest living in a burn scar. But there's been renewed interest in remote areas like Malibu Lake since people can work from home and live farther from urban centers. So now McLaughlin's getting more buyers, even as home insurance rates for fire-prone areas have gone up.
I don't think fire insurance ever really dissuades somebody from buying unless it's an outrageous amount, you know. And I haven't had that be the case on any of the properties subsequent to COVID.
For homeowners like Kat Merrick, it's worth the rebuild.
You can see the ocean and also then turn the other direction and you're looking at the Topatopas in the evening as the sun sets, you know. And as we've been told by friends that are in the real estate business, you'll never find a property like that again in Ventura County. You just won't. You won't.
And Lee Rittenauer has lived in the same spot since 1979. He calls himself an old-timer in his neighborhood and wears it like a badge of honor. He says fire's just a part of life here.
Well, I don't know. You know, the earthquake happens, the tsunami comes. Take your choice, you know. It's like, and so I've been in L.A. my whole life, you know, so I understand it. I roll with it, and I'll take my chances.
Wildfire is a bigger part of life for Californians than it's ever been. But even as the state gets drier and the chances of wildfire rise, some Californians will continue to reconstruct and roll the dice again. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
We're facing a potentially record-breaking fire season that threatens the health of many California communities once again this year. So, what questions do you have about wildfires? And call us at 424-538-8581. That's 424-538-8581. Or check us out at kcrw.com and tell us what you think or whatever questions you might have.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. California has been reopened for almost a month now, but the pandemic has not disappeared. The Delta variant is highly contagious, and it's spreading. The CDC estimates that it's now the dominant strain in the United States. Close to 60% of all Californians are vaccinated. Here in LA County, 60% of all residents are fully vaccinated. That includes children 12 years of age and older. But if you're one of the parents with children 12 and under, navigating the world, whether or not to eat indoors or take a kid to a zoo, well, that can still feel pretty unsettling. Jessica Besbris is a palliative neurologist at Cedars-Sinai Hospital here in Los Angeles. She is also a parent. Hey, Jessica.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
We have this variant of SARS coronavirus 2. How concerned are you about the Delta variant?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll say this, my concern comes from my place as a parent of two small children who are not eligible for vaccination. You know, not from my clinical expertise, since I'm not an infectious disease specialist, but as a parent of someone, of two someones who don't have that protection of a vaccine yet, I am concerned. You know, anything that that threatens to spread throughout our community, affect my patients, affect my family, is very concerning to me.
You mentioned your kids, obviously, and they're unable to get vaccinated. How do you protect them from it when so many people are being more relaxed in terms of masking and social distancing and, you know, assuming that this is all over?
Yeah. So I think we've been fairly strict in our family, and I want to say, you know, every family has to make their own decisions about how they're going to protect members who are unable to be vaccinated. But my kids, you know, one of them is one and doesn't know a whole lot other than what I demonstrate. But, you know, our four-year-old knows that he wears his mask whenever we go anywhere. He knows to give lots of space, we call it, and to give people plenty of room when they're passing. And we're very cautious about who we interact with. And I don't think that's going to change regardless of what variant is floating around until my children themselves are eligible to be vaccinated.
Are you going out to eat indoors? Are you going to the mall? Are you going shopping with the kids? You mentioned that they're pretty, you know, deliberative about how they go about their, you know, ways with the masks and the social distancing. But are you trying to get back to life as it was?
We are trying to get back to life, the happiest life that we can safely allow now. And so we try to engage in lots of outdoor activities, you know, where we can keep a safe distance. You know, we mostly take our meals at home still, and I'll be honest that we haven't started engaging in indoor activities with the kids yet, but we are trying to expand the outdoor activities that they can safely enjoy so that they can have that joy in their childhood, even despite everything that's going on.
What about camps and daycare centers? Are you sending your kids to camp or to daycare?
The little one, no. We have made a personal choice to send our four-year-old to camp with diligent mask wearing and a lot of in-school testing. But it's sort of a day-to-day decision, meaning we're always looking at the case rates and asking ourselves the question of whether the risk-benefit still favors sending him every day.
What do you think it's going to take for you to feel better, more confident about eating inside at a restaurant or going to the mall or going, you know, to an indoor store, resuming more of that normal life with your kids?
Yeah, I really think for me personally, I need to see them vaccinated. I need to know that they have protection in them, because I can't expect every single person around them to behave in the way I'd like or the way that I feel is the most responsible. And there may be people out there in the world who, just like my children, don't have the ability to be vaccinated and are trying to live as normal a life as they can. So I can only control what I can. And I think I'll only feel safe and confident, truly, truly safe for my children when they're eligible and have received their vaccines.
I mean, you're mainly concerned about your kids because they're not vaccinated, right? Ages 4 and 1. But we have heard that kids, particularly young kids, generally don't get very sick from the virus, right?
You know, you're absolutely right that that, you know, the information that's out there would suggest that children get sick at a lower rate than other individuals, for example, the elderly. That said, there's just so much we don't know about this virus and its long-term consequences. And I don't think any parent wants to see their child get sick if they can prevent it. And so my instinct as a parent is to try to protect my children, because that's the best thing I can possibly do for them, is to keep them as safe as I possibly can. You know, it's not only my kids I'm worried about, though. You know, I'm a clinician and I do work in a hospital, and every patient I see who comes in with COVID, who's sick enough to be in the hospital with COVID. You know, I just wish that it's something we could have prevented for them and for their family.
Jessica Bespris, palliative neurologist over at Cedars-Sinai Hospital here in Los Angeles. Jessica, thank you for all you've done and for all you're doing. We really do appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's turn now to Dr. Marcy Hardart. She's a pediatrician at 10th Street Pediatrics in Santa Monica. Dr. Hardart, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
So you just heard the concerns that Jessica Bespris has for her one-year-old and her four-year-old. I'm sure you're hearing similar things from a lot of parents who have kids that are too young to get the vaccine. What are you telling them now that things are starting to open back up?
Well, this has been a very difficult year for our kids, as it has been for everybody. And for kids not to be out and around other kids, you know, that can take a toll on them. So we do want our kids to have a life, but we have to weigh the risks and benefits. So the best way to protect our children is to have them surrounded by vaccinated people as much as possible. So if your family has everyone possible vaccinated, having kids go to school, having kids go to camps, it's not zero risk, but it's a fairly low risk. And so I think it's reasonable to have them go. And I think that it's important for them to have that social interaction in their lives.
We've been hearing since early in the pandemic that young kids are far less likely to get sick from COVID. Does that still hold true, even with the Delta variant?
As of now, yes, that is still holding true. We're not seeing children get very sick, but the Delta variant is an unknown, and everything we're hearing is that it is more contagious and that the vaccines don't work as well. They work fairly well, but not as well as they did against the other variants. So it's something we have to keep watching. But it's still true that children don't tend to get as sick. There are some kids, though, that do get very sick and hospitalized, and some that don't make it. So we can't discount that.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly very serious. And you just heard Jessica Bespris say that she is sending her four-year-old to summer camp. Do you have any advice for parents about summer camp, about sending, you know, their kids, their young kids back to school in the fall?
Well, we hope that the schools and the camps have good things in place for testing and for having the kids outside as much as possible and mask wearing when they're inside. I do think that masks are still important for kids. Whether or not they need to wear them outside, we're hearing differing things from the CDC and the WHO. But I think just trying to maintain distance as much as possible, but still letting them play with their friends and keep people away from school if they're sick. And we'll have to just keep watching and see what happens with the Delta variant.
I mean, it's becoming the dominant strain, right? I mean, it's more contagious than the other variants, I think. And I think people hear, you know, just how dangerous it is, and that viruses mutate, right? They find the weakest link to be able to sort of get in there.
Correct. And that's why we hope that everybody who can get vaccinated will get vaccinated, because that gives the Delta variant less of a way to get into the community. But as of now, we are still not seeing children get very sick from COVID. We are not seeing a lot of child-to-child transmission, but we're keeping an eye out for that to see if that changes with the Delta variant as we see more of it.
I suspect, doctor, that you're no stranger to vaccine hesitancy, not just COVID vaccine, but any vaccine, right? Diphtheria, like the other stuff. I'm wondering if you're seeing any similar resistance among parents when it comes to the COVID vaccine, like for kids old enough to get the vaccine, 12 and over, or even for themselves.
We are seeing some, not a lot. Parents, by and large, in our practice, are getting vaccinated. We have a few that are hesitant about it. I am hearing some parents hesitant about the idea of giving it to their younger children when it's available. And I always remind them that the studies show that the risk of the vaccines are very low, and the risk of dangerous side effects from COVID itself are far higher than any risks of the vaccine itself. we'll have to see how it is when the vaccine gets opened up for the younger children, for the 6 and up or the ages 2 and up, which hopefully will come this fall. I hope that parents will be open to the idea of vaccinating their children, because I think that is the only way we're going to be completely safe.
Certainly something you're watching and we're watching too, and we'd love to get an update down the road. Dr. Marcy Hardart, pediatrician over at 10th Street Pediatrics in Santa Monica. Doctor, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Well, there is hope and there are challenges when it comes to COVID. The hope is that if you haven't already, you will get vaccinated and the virus will continue to slowly wane. The challenge for public health officials is that maybe you won't get vaccinated and the virus will continue to mutate into more serious strains like the Delta variant. In the meantime, there is no shortage of folks feeling the economic pain of the pandemic and people who are there to help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, have a because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
The Sisters of Watts is made up of four sisters who have been serving the residents of that neighborhood since well before COVID-19. They've been handing out free backpacks to kids, haircuts for the homeless, meals to senior citizens, groceries, even helping people get vaccinated. Robin Daniels is CEO and co-founder of the group, and she joins me right now. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
You've lived in Watts since you were four, since you were just a toddler. Talk about some of the needs of the community that you and your sisters are trying to meet.
Yes, been there since I was 4 years old. We grew up around Ted Watkins Park at the time, well, Rear Rogers Park at the time. As we grew up, we saw a lot of needs that was needed in Watts because we was low-income family in Watts, and we saw that we didn't do a lot. We didn't get to go places. We didn't go see a lot of places. So as we came together, some of our neighbors we call sisters, we all came together and say, hey, let's start something where we can start giving back to our community. And that's how that came about.
So this is a family affair, right? It's you and your three sisters.
It's actually our three sister and our neighbor that we call our sister. So that's how we came up with Sisters of Watts. Because we are sisters.
you were focused on feeding Watts residents during the pandemic, right? I mean, is that continuing?
Yes, we are. We was focused on Watts, and now we started back feeding the community. As of last Tuesday, we started back feeding the community because there's still food. I mean, people still need help with food in our community.
People need food and people need vaccinations too, although some people are hesitant to get those vaccinations. I know your organization has also been working with the city's mobile vaccination units to find the people, the residents who are not vaccinated, convince them to show up. How's that been going?
Yeah, so we have been going out, letting people know about the vaccination because everybody look at the news about it ain't good, but I did receive my vaccination. I didn't have no problem, no symptom of nothing. So I let them know, hey, I took it. I didn't have no problem. I wasn't sick. And then it was fine to take. So once they hear out a person's mouth that took it, then a lot of them be like, oh, okay, I can go take it now.
What are some of the reasons why they didn't want to get the vaccination? Did they tell you?
Someone was worried because listening to what they see on the news, listen to other people talk that did not get the vaccine. And so that's why a lot of people was worried about it.
I know about 50% of the people in Watts have been vaccinated, according to the LA Public Health Department. That's lower than other areas, much lower than wealthier parts of LA, by the way. Do you think your community has hit a plateau, or do you think you can still convince people to get vaccinated?
We still letting people know to get vaccinated. We did a big Juneteenth event, and we have someone out there doing vaccination. So people was getting the shot when we did the Juneteenth event on June 19th. And our local park is doing one right now, so we are sending people over there. So could people continue to receive the vaccine?
Well, I want to thank you. Seriously, what you're doing in the community and making a difference. Robin Daniels, the co-founder of Sisters of Watts, the CEO of the organization. Thank you so much for coming on, and thanks again for all your work in that community.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you, too.
That's it for today. Next week, as LA reopens and nightclubs try to get back to some sense of post-pandemic normal, there's something to think about. Oh yeah, the pandemic's not over. And yet the crowds are doing what they do, crowding, vaccinated or not. Check us out online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Get the podcast delivered fresh to your feed and tell us how you're doing. Tell us how we're doing. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geist, John Meek, Sue Margulies, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Tom, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl, all vital to this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your time and your presence tonight. Have a great night.